The woman is obviously a gold digger, Santon said firmly. Oh, we can't be sure of that, Mater, Charza demurred. I have heard that she is a damn good architect. That has absolutely nothing to do with it. She is old enough to be his mother. She is after one thing and one thing only. We'll have to put a stop to this immediately, otherwise it could get out of hand. It's the talk of the town. All my friends are gloating. They were at Kelvin Grove on Saturday, smooching all over the dance floor. Oh, I think it'll blow over, Charza suggested. Just so long as we take no notice. Gary hasn't slept at Weltevrieden for a week. The woman is as blatant and shameless. Santon broke off and shook her head. You'll have to speak to her. Me? Charza raised an eyebrow. You are good with females. I'd be sure to lose my temper with the hussy. Charza sighed, although secretly he welcomed the excuse to have a look at this Holly Carmichael. He couldn't imagine what Gary's taste in woman would be. The lad had never given any indications before. Charza imagined sensible shoes and horn-rimmed glasses, fat and fortyish, serious and erudite, and he shuddered. All right, Mater, I'll warn her off. And if that doesn't work, we can always send Gary down to the vet to be fixed. I wish you wouldn't joke about something as worrying as this, said Santon severely. Although Holly had been expecting it for almost a month, when the call finally came, the shock of it was unmitigated. Charza Courtney had addressed the businesswomen's club the previous year, so she recognised his voice instantly, and was glad that it was he rather than Santon Courtney she had to contend with. Mrs. Carmichael, my son Gary has shown me some of your preliminary sketches for the Charzaville township. As you know, Courtney Mining and Finance are considerable shareholders in the project, although Gary is responsible for the development. I hoped we could meet to exchange a few ideas. She had suggested her own office, but Charza neatly thwarted her attempt to choose the field of battle, and sent a chauffeur to bring her out to Weltevrieden in the Rolls. She realised that she was being deliberately placed in surroundings which were intended to overpower her, and show her up in the splendour of a world in which there was no place for her. So she went to endless pains with her dress and appearance. And as she was ushered into Charza Courtney's study, she saw him start, and knew that first blood was hers. She made the room, with all its treasures, seem as though it had been designed around her, and Charza Courtney's cool, supercilious smile faded as he came to take her hand. "What a magnificent Turner," she said. "I always think he must have been an early riser. The sunlight only has that golden lustre in the early morning." His expression changed again as he realised there was depth below her striking exterior. They circled the room, ostensibly admiring the other paintings, fencing elegantly, testing each other for weakness and finding none, until Charza deliberately broke the pattern with a direct personal compliment to fluster her. "You have the most remarkable eyes," he said, and watched her keenly to see how she would react. She counterattacked instantly. "Gary calls them amethyst and sapphire." She had wrong-footed him neatly. He had expected her to avoid that name until he raised it. "Yes, I understand the two of you have been working closely." He went to the ivory inlaid table, on which glasses and decanters had been set out. "May I offer you one of our sherries? We're very proud of them." He brought her the glass and looked into those extraordinary eyes. "The little devil," he thought ruefully. "He's done it again. Who would have expected Gary to come up with something like this?" She sipped the wine. "I like it," she said. "It's dry as flint, without any astringency." He inclined his head slightly to acknowledge the accuracy of her judgment. "I can see that it would be fruitless to attempt to obfuscate. I didn't ask you here to discuss the Charzaville project." "That's good," she said, "because I didn't even bother to bring the latest drawings." He laughed delightedly. "Let's sit down and get comfortable." She chose the Louis XIV chair with Aubusson embroidered upholstery because she had seen the twin to it in the Victoria and Albert Museum, and she crossed one ankle over the other and watched him struggle to get his eyes back up again. "I had fully intended to buy you off," he said. "I realise, after having met you, that would have been a mistake." She said nothing, but watched him over the rim of the glass, and her foot swung like a metronome, with the same ominous rhythm. "I wondered what price to set," he went on, "and the figure of 100,000 came to mind." The foot kept swinging, and despite himself, Shaza glanced down at her calf and exquisitely turned ankle. "Of course that was ludicrous," he went on, still watching her foot in the Italian leather court shoe. "I realise now that I should have considered at least 500,000. He was trying to find her price, and he looked back at her face, searching for the first glint of avarice. But it was hard to concentrate. Sapphire and amethyst, forsooth. Gary's hormones must be boiling out of his ears. And Shaza felt a stab of envy. "Naturally, I was thinking in pounds sterling. I haven't adjusted to this rand business yet." "How fortunate, Mr. Courtney," she said, "that you decided not to insult us both. This way we can be friends. I'd prefer that." All right, that didn't work out the way he had planned. He set down his sherry glass. "Gary is still a child," he changed tack. She shook her head. "He's a man." It just needed somebody to convince him of that. It wasn't difficult to do. "He doesn't know his own mind. He is one of the most definite and determined men I have ever met. He knows exactly what he wants, and he will do anything to get it." She waited a moment to let the challenge contained in those words become clearer. Then she repeated softly, "Anything." "Yes," he agreed softly. "That's a Courtney family trait. We will do anything to get what we want, or to destroy anything that stands in our way." He paused, just as she had done, and then repeated quietly, "Anything." "You had 3 sons, Shaza Courtney. You have 1 left. Are you willing to take that chance?" He reared back in his chair and stared at her. She was unprepared for the agony that she saw in his expression, and for a moment she thought she had gone too far. Then he subsided slowly. "You fight hard and dirty," he acknowledged sadly. "When it is worthwhile." She knew it was dangerous with an opponent of this calibre, but she felt sorry for him. "And for me, this is worthwhile." "For you, yes, I can see that, but for Gary?" "I think I owe you complete honesty. At the beginning, it was a little bit of daring. I was intrigued by his youth. That in itself can be devastatingly appealing. And by the other obvious attractions which you have hinted at. The Courtney Empire and his place in it?" "Yes. I would have been less than human if that hadn't interested me. That's the way it started. But almost immediately it began to change." "In what way?" "I began to understand his enormous potential, and my own influence in developing it fully. Haven't you noticed any change in him in the 3 months since we have been together? Can you truly tell me my influence on him has been detrimental?" Despite himself, Shaza smiled. "The pinstripe suits and the horn-rimmed glasses, they are a vast improvement, I'll admit. Those are only the unimportant outward signs of the important inward changes. In 3 months, Gary has become a mature and confident man. He has discovered many of his own strengths and talents and virtues, not the least of which is a warm and loving disposition. With my help, he will discover all the others." "So you see yourself in the role of architect still, building a marble palace out of clay bricks." "Don't mock him." She was angry, protective and defensive as a lioness. "He's probably the best of all the Courtneys, and I am probably the best thing that will ever happen to him in his life." He stared at her and exclaimed with wonder as it dawned upon him. "You love him. You really, really love him." "So you understand at last." She stood up and turned towards the door. "Holly," he said, and the unexpected use of her first name arrested her. She wavered, still pale with anger, and he went on softly. "I didn't understand. Forgive me. I think Gary is a fortunate young man to have found you." He held out his hand. "You said we might be friends. Is that still possible?" Table Bay is wide open to the northwesterly gales that bore in off the wintry grey Atlantic. The ferry took the short, steep seas on her bows and lurched over the crests, throwing the spray as high as the stubby masthead. It was the first time Vicky had ever been at sea, and the motion terrified her as nothing on earth had ever done. She clutched the child to her and stared straight ahead, but it was difficult to maintain her balance on the hard wooden bench, and thick spray dashed against the porthole and poured over the glass in a wavering mirage that distorted her view. The island looked like some dreadful creature swimming to meet them, and she recalled all the legends of her tribe of the monsters that came out of the sea and devoured any human being found upon the shore. She was glad that Joseph was with her. Her half-brother had grown into a fine young man. He reminded her of the faded photograph of her grandfather, Imbijan Dinizulu, that her mother kept on the wall of her hut. Joseph had the same broad forehead and widespread eyes, and although his nose was not flattened but high-bridged, his clean-shaven chin was rounded and full. He had just completed his law degree at the Black University of Fort Hare. But before he underwent his consecration into the hereditary role of Zulu chieftainship, Vicky had prevailed upon him to accompany her upon the long journey down the length of the subcontinent. As soon as he returned to the district of Ladyburg in Zululand, he would begin his training for the chieftainship. This was not the initiation to which the young men of Khoza and the other tribes were forced to submit. Joseph would not suffer the brutal mutilation of ritual circumcision. King Shaka had abolished that custom. He had not tolerated the time that his young warriors wasted in recuperation, which could better be spent in military training. Joseph stood beside Vicky, balancing easily to the ferry's agitated plunges, and he placed his hand upon her shoulder to reassure her. "Not much longer," he murmured. "We will soon be there." Vicky shook her head vehemently and clutched her son more securely to her bosom. The cold sweat broke out upon her forehead, and waves of nausea assailed her, but she fought them back. "I am a daughter of a chief," she told herself, "and the wife of a king. I will not surrender to womanly weakness." The ferry ran out of the gale into the calm waters in the lee of the island, and Vicky drew a long, ragged breath and stood up. Her legs were unsteady, and Joseph helped her to the rail. They stood side by side and stared at the bleak and infamous silhouette of Robben Island. The name derived from the Dutch word for seal, and the colonies of these animals that the first explorers had discovered upon its barren rocks. When the fishing and sealing industries based upon the island failed, it was used as a leper colony and a place of banishment for political prisoners, most of them black. Even Makana, the prophet and warrior, who had led the first Khoza onslaughts against the white settlers across the Great Fish River, had been sent here after his capture, and here he had died in 1820, drowned in the roaring seas that beat upon the island as he tried to escape. For 50 years his people had refused to believe he was dead, and to this day his name was a rallying cry for the tribe. 143 years later, there was another prophet and warrior imprisoned upon the island, and Vicky stared out across the narrowing strip of water at the low, square, unlovely structure, the new high-security prison for dangerous political prisoners where Moses Gama was now incarcerated. After his stay of execution, Moses had remained on death row at Pretoria Central Prison for almost 2 years, until final mitigation of the death sentence to life imprisonment at hard labour had been officially granted by the state president, and he had been transferred to the island. Moses was allowed one visit every 6 months, and Vicky was bringing his son to see him. The journey had not been easy, for Vicky herself was the subject of a banning order. She had shown herself an enemy of the state by her appearances at Moses' trial, dressed in the colours of the African National Congress, and her inflammatory utterances, which were widely reported by the news media. Even to leave the township of Drake's Farm, to which the banning order confined her, she had to obtain a travel permit from the local magistrate, This document set out precisely the terms upon which she was allowed to travel, the exact time which she was required to leave her cottage, the route and means of transport she must take, the duration of her visit to her husband, and the route she must take upon her return journey. The ferry manoeuvred in towards the jetty, and there were uniformed warders to seize the mooring ropes as they were thrown across. Joseph took the boy's hand from her, and with his free hand helped Vicky across the narrow gap. They stood together on the wooden boards of the jetty and looked around uncertainly. The warders ignored them as they went on with the business of docking and unloading the ferry. It was 10 minutes before one of them called across to them, "All right, come this way!" And they followed him up the paved road towards the security block.